Chapter 25. Even all those years later, I couldn't help wondering how things might have turned out if I had acted differently, more decisively. I found myself recollecting what had happened when I told Lady Margaret what Alice asked me to say, that she was all right, that she had a plan, and that for the time being we must not intervene. She disclosed something then that showed Alice's mother to me in a rather different light. I'm trying to remember how she put it exactly. "She looks young," she said, "but she isn't as young as she looks. She was older than my brother when they married, by 3 or 4 years. The boy, Archie, was born only 7 months after the wedding, and you have never seen such a huge, healthy child. Do you understand what I'm telling you?" I nodded, and she went on. "My parents chose to see it as a young couple's rashness, ill-advised and shaming, but ultimately rectified by the marriage. I wonder now if they saw more than they admitted. You see, my brother only met her the month before they married. I know. I was there that evening to see him lose his head over her." I can't quite explain why, but suddenly much about Alice's mother made sense. The way she had doted on Archie and neglected her daughter, the absolute fear she had of scandal of any sort. But it stunned me, too, that she, the apogee of decorum and seemliness, could have been involved in such deceit. Lady Margaret must have seen the expression on my face, because she laughed and said, "I can see that I have shocked you. Believe me, although there is no love lost between her and me, I do not say this simply to blacken her name. I have a horror of gossip for its own sake. I am telling you because it is worth bearing in mind what she is capable of." Kate and Oliver went out on the boat that evening to take photographs of the shore. As soon as they returned for supper, I knew that some new thing had occurred. The silence between them across the table had a weight and texture to it that had not been there before. I was intrigued, but I also felt, how to describe it, not envy exactly, but some close cousin of it. For I understood then, as I had not before, that I would never again share that particular sort of silence with another person. I worried for them too. I reminded myself firmly that there was nothing I could do about it. After all, it was exactly what I had secretly begun to hope for. But now that it seemed it might become a possibility, I was all too aware of everything that was at stake. The next morning, I decided to tell Kate about that last time I saw Alice in England. It was late summer, and I was working in a solicitor's office. I had gained, to everyone's surprise, including my own, a first-class degree from Oxford. I knew instantly that this success would work against me. If I had scraped a third, I might have been left to my own devices. Instead, I now appeared to be destined for a life of intellectual pursuits. My father had got much worse in those last few years before his death. He was still at the firm, but his hours had been greatly reduced. He wasn't well enough to work full time. In truth, he wasn't well enough to work at all, but they kept him on out of loyalty. For more than a decade it had been eating away at him, this disease of the mind, and most of the time he was unrecognizable from the man he had once been. There would have been no question of leaving my mother to cope with him alone, and the responsibility of helping her fell to me. My older sister Rosa now lived in Islington with her young family, and my other sister, Caro, had married in the summer and moved to Nova Scotia, and so I had returned to live in the house in Fulham. The job was in a solicitor's office in Silk Street, Locke and Proudfoot, and my position was that of a glorified clerk. The work bored me, and the boredom made me stupid, that I seemed to spread half my time correcting my own blunders. I'm sure that my employer, old Mr. Proudfoot, wondered whether the first-class student he had been promised had swapped places with some moron changeling. The one saving grace was that the hours were good. If I managed to make few enough errors to be able to finish undoing them by 6 o'clock, I would be home in time to fit in some drawing before supper. That was what I was hoping for the day she came to find me. It was a golden evening, and I was walking home across that small triangle of earth they rather optimistically called the green. Something about the figure on the bench made me stop in my tracks. I can't explain what it was that drew my eye to her exactly. Perhaps it was the running dog, returning to its master, that sped through the space between us. Or maybe it was the strange pull she exerted upon me. From that distance I could not have been sure it was her by sight, and yet I knew that it was. She had fallen asleep, slumped slightly to one side. I remember it so clearly, the way she looked when I stood over her, wondering whether or not to wake her. Her face was thin and drawn. She seemed an entirely different person from the Alice I had seen only a few months previously.